Register readers, and welcome to episode 14 of Semi-Coherent Computing. This is Ashley Vance, and we've got a bit of a different show for you today. It's less geek and kind of more personality. We've got Patrick Byrne, the CEO of Overstock.com, which is a tech company, but we're not going to be burrowing down into nitty-gritty chip details today. Patrick, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here, Ashley.
And we've also got the Register's very own Cade Metz, who's our intrepid internet editor, and he's done some stories involving Patrick and Wikipedia, and we'll be getting into that a little bit later on. Cade?
Can I just say that I'm shocked to find the two of you in the same room, smiling at each other? I thought you were sworn enemies.
I should add, you know, Patrick is my second guest that's been on the Charlie Rose show, but I don't want to go Charlie Rose and babble on too much about myself, but I will set up a little context for the show, which is that I think it was 2004, maybe 2005, I ordered something from Overstock.com, and we won't go into all the minutia, but Patrick and I got acquainted as I was going through the customer service system, and we exchanged a few heated emails, and the Register gave Patrick a pretty tough time, so he's a good sport to come.
No, you guys were fair. You were fair, and I'm sorry. We blew an order, and it was just when we were blowing a number of orders in a bad 3 or 4 month period. So I'm glad now that I hope we cleaned it up to your satisfaction.
Absolutely, and as Cade mentions, it's just funny because I think in 2005, the odds of this happening would have been perhaps.
Actually, I've never had any hard feelings at all. I was happy to meet you last year when you did that Teradata story. But you seemed, I could tell that you thought I must have bore, you know, had a big chip on my shoulder. I don't know, but I was very happy to meet you.
You never know as a Register reporter when you're going to get like a knife in the back. You got to be careful. So anyway, Patrick, people listening to the show might not be totally familiar, but he's one of the more kind of entertaining and brash and straightforward characters you'll find in the technology industry, and especially for a CEO. And he's lived, you know, an eventful life, to say the least. So we were going to spend the first part of the show digging just a little bit into his background, and then we're going to move on to talk a little bit about, it's nothing less than Patrick's war on Wall Street, actually, which you don't find too many CEOs doing, and then also some battles with Wikipedia, like we mentioned, the Registers. Cade's done a number of stories on this. Patrick, you know, I've got a lot of information on your background. I mean, you've obviously started an online retailer. You got a PhD in philosophy from Stanford. You hung out with Warren Buffett. You've biked across the U.S., beat cancer 3 times, been to Cambridge, talked about your sexual preferences and possible...
I did not. That's not true. Now, that's the only... That was the only misstatement in your article. I told us... I'll correct
that
if you get a
chance. Let's go back to your early days. You grew up in Vermont and New Hampshire, is that right?
Well, my teenage years, yeah. I was actually born in Indiana, and I come from sort of Irish working-class families from southern Jersey. Born in Indiana and grew up around New England, basically. In my teenage years, I spent a few years in just outside D.C.
Okay.
But I think of myself as from Vermont and New Hampshire.
And then you went to Dartmouth as an undergrad, right?
Yes.
And studied?
I studied philosophy and Asian studies.
Okay, okay.
So Western philosophy and Chinese. I became aware when I was about 5 or 6 that I was the reincarnation of a Shaolin monk. Uh-huh. I think I watched too many... Kung Fu episodes or something. Yeah. So anyway, I became enamored of matter of Far East Asia very early.
I see. And you were diagnosed with cancer after your undergraduate years, is that right?
Right. Just a couple of weeks after college. Turns out I was probably sick for about 2 years in college and just getting weaker and weaker and losing weight. Just after I graduated, I had cancer.
Okay.
I was diagnosed.
And it recurred 2 different times, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, you talked about this with Charlie Rose, among other people. This has certainly shaped your personality, no?
It's funny. Some people have told me that it didn't change me at all. I think it changed... I'm not sure. A lot of people say it didn't change me. I was already off the beaten track, but having that happen and really take up the 3 years of my life right after college meant I was pushed so far off the normal track that any lingering temptation I had had to return to sort of the normal path in life was gone.
Well, I mean, it's sort of a cliche to say that, you know, if you're faced with death, that from there on out you're intent on living life to the fullest. But one of the other things I wanted to ask about is that, you know, one of your other qualities is that you obviously don't care what the rest of the world thinks about you, okay? And, which is a quality I certainly admire, and I think everyone should aspire to. Is there a connection there? If you're faced with that sort of dilemma,
I think so. So some people have told me I'm just autistic. Any sense of what people care? But to me, yeah, I'm sure part of it comes from, you know, there was everybody knows the story of Pavlov's dogs, the Russian psychologist, and they'd ring the bells and they would salivate and such. Well, there's a part of the story I've never been able to confirm, but I have read that there were floods in Pavlov's laboratory and a whole bunch of the dogs who were kept in cages in the basement were drowned. And then, but a couple of them survived. And when he tested them, they had lost that Pavlovian response. I guess the lesson is a very intense near-death experience sort of can deprogram you from patterns that have been laid down. Maybe that's part of it. I don't know. That may be a longer answer than you want.
Okay. Well, as Ashley mentioned, you were also a Marshall Scholar and went to Cambridge. So this was after the cancer?
Yes.
Okay.
So that's curious, though. I mean, let me back up one step just before we do that. You were a pretty serious athlete at Dartmouth. Is that right?
Yes.
I mean, what was it, cycling that you were doing then? Or?
I played college football. I was a boxer. I had wrestled and done boxing all through high school. And my plan was really to get out of college and go be the great white dope.
Yeah, I thought you said, I saw you say somewhere that you thought you'd be a professional athlete,
yeah,
more or less. Right. And then, so obviously, the cancer put the short-term kibosh on that.
Right, not just the short-term. They cracked my chest 3 times, and I have a whole bunch of tubes and wires and such in me. So pretty much, I actually did later in my late 20s. I was feeling well enough too. I was pretty much an invalid through most of my 20s. And then near the end of my 20s, I trained up and tried to make it as a fighter, but I couldn't. I never had the wind after that, especially I had a certain kind of chemotherapy that destroys your lung capacity.
But you did the bike ride across the U.S. after you had cancer. It was kind of...
Multiple times.
Yeah, I'm very slow. I'm a very slow bicyclist. I could never get my max VO2 uptake over about 38, which is sort of a measure of your cardiovascular health. So I just very slowly crossed the country.
Right. You
know, 12, 13 miles an hour.
How many times did you do it?
I did it 3 times back when I had cancer, once for each time I had cancer. And then I did it again about 7 years ago as part of a fundraising effort. 3 of the 4 were solo, and one of them was with my brother John.
So then, as Cade was mentioning, the next step was kind of Cambridge.
Mm-hmm. In the middle, after I'd had cancer one time, I was admitted to Stanford, and I came out to study mathematical logic, and the philosophy department had this great program, and I was here about 3 months, and I won a Marshall Fellowship and got sick again, actually, on the same week, actually on the same day. I got the news I won the Marshall Fellowship, went home, and that night, more graphic detail than you wanted. I was in and out of the hospital for a couple of years. Stanford was great, let me do a bunch of courses from within the hospital. And then when I felt well enough, the Marshall people had let me put off the scholarship. I went over to England and spent 2 years at Cambridge.
So even though, you know, you're battling cancer, and Cade was touching on some of the how this may or may not change your life, you still kind of went the academic route. You might think that somebody at that point would be like, well, screw this. I'm not sitting inside a classroom studying, or I'm not going to just spend my time inside this.
I was really an invalid those years, and I didn't have the energy. I couldn't have done anything anyway other than, sit home and read or something.
Right.
So it was a nice way to spend my time, and I actually, beyond that, I was obviously very concerned with sort of the whole question of man's place in the universe and such. I mean, it came from, I think, a sincere desire to try to figure things out.
I was an undergrad philosophy major. Have you seen the website, theduckrabbit.com?
No, but I know Wittgenstein's
Duck Rabbit. Do you know where it comes from?
Yeah.
It's kind of funny, though. I don't know if I'm wrong, but I saw a study somewhere where I think it said most CEOs' philosophy degree was the most common degree of Fortune 500 CEOs. I don't know if it's accurate, but I'm sure I saw that.
It wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah.
It wouldn't surprise me.
Just the analytical thinking or...
Understand. Well, first of all, a good philosophy program prepares you to communicate. You have to know what you want to say and be able to say it and structure it so other people can understand it. In addition, it makes you think about the deep principles, I hope, underlying things, especially the Anglo-American tradition. I'm not a big fan of continental philosophy, but the Anglo-American tradition tends to make people quite analytic, and that transfers well into either law or business. In fact, I've been surprised when I first got into business, I'd be in meetings, you know, with lawyers and different businessmen arguing about business people arguing about some point, and I would realize a lot of times they were talking past each other and they thought they were all arguing. They weren't. They didn't have their definitions clear. They didn't. And just by using those sort of basic sophomore analytical, you know, philosophy techniques, you could tease apart what they were really saying and realize and stitch together agreements between people that they didn't even realize was within their feasibility set.
So while you're getting this degree, I mean, did you have an eye on the business world? Did that come later?
Actually, always had an eye on the business world. I was one of those teenagers who did different little, I had a few years, ran a Christmas tree lot and sold Christmas trees and did, and so I always was doing sort of small scale entrepreneurship and more dabbling in philosophy. And then after, while I had cancer, I sort of gave up the business and became focused on trying to figure out, was there any meaning? Was there any meaning in life?
You must have felt at some point like you were kind of cursed.
Sometimes you can look at it all as molecular biology and it doesn't have any greater meaning. And other times you look at it as, is this a story? If this were a movie, what lesson am I supposed to be learning here? And it did actually reach that point. Funny you asked.
We can confirm that your life is a movie. You don't have to worry about that. So you get your PhD from Stanford. Did you immediately make the leap to the business world?
Actually, what happened was when I came back from England, I started straddling business and academia. I started going back. There had been a big SNL disaster in the U.S., and the government had scraped together all these junk assets and stitched them into a corporation called the Resolution Trust Corporation. And my brother and I got in the business of buying bankrupt properties and trying to fix them and do things with them. And then in between these different episodes and projects we worked on, I was coming out to Stanford, and I worked for a quarter here, a quarter there. So I was straddling the line for about 4 years between business and academia. And then what happened was in 1995, the line, the straddle got too wide to maintain, and there was a certain business project which the company needed a CEO for the and so I said, I'll step in. It was a small 20-man manufacturing company, 20-person.
This was your father's business?
No. This was a little manufacturing company in New Hampshire.
Okay.
And so I had done a couple of real estate projects and such and had a little bit of capital stitched together, and then I led a group of investors to make this, I think it was a $4 million acquisition, a group of about 15 or 20 people. We all got together and bought this. And then this small manufacturing, yeah, I think it had 24 people in it. We ran it, then about 6 months later, there was some trouble that made the CEO step down. So I stepped in for what I thought was going to be sort of a 3-month stint until we found a real CEO. And then ever since then, it's been like Al Pacino in Godfather 3. Every time I start to get out, they suck me back in.
This was Centricut?
That was Centricut.
Okay, so I read they made industrial torches?
They made the consumable tip for plasma torches, and there's different ways of cutting metal. Anytime you make something out of metal, shipyards or whatever, they're cutting metal, and there's either oxyacetylene or plasma.
So, and you're saying before you come from working class stock, and I've heard you talk about, I think, driving a beat up old pickup truck, if I'm not mistaken, for a few years. But at the same time, your father's a well known businessman who was the chairman of Geico, among other things, which is a company owned by Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway. So, I mean, did you come back? You must have come from a pretty well-off background just with your immediate family.
Well, my family lived, absolutely. My family lived the Horatio Alger dream. When I was conceived, my father and my parents were on the GI Bill. He was a grad student and everything. But by the time I was, you know, in my teenage years, well, we had risen that socioeconomic ladder. He moved to Geico when I was 13, and it was then a near bankrupt auto insurer. and he moved there, and he was supposed to sort of take it through bankruptcy. And he was there about a month before he got this phone call that there was some guy out in Omaha buying his stock. And at the time, no one had ever heard of this funny guy in Omaha. But this funny guy in Omaha showed up at our house and would stay with us. And I look back, and the course of my life changed from a dozen to my parents, education was sacred. And yet, whenever this guy came, his name was Warren Buffett, and I don't want to take around saying, I know Warren Buffett, but I've known Mr. Buffett since I was 13.
I'll take responsibility for bringing it up.
True story that he met my dad, and they sat up all night talking. And at dawn, we'd never had a new car, and my father had an order in for our family's first new car. And at dawn, Buffett went out and basically started buying up a third of Geico. And my father went out and canceled his order on his new car and put the money into Berkshire Hathaway stock at about $60 a share. So it worked out, well for both of them.
Yeah. So, that was obviously an ongoing relationship between your father and Warren. And, I mean, if I'm not wrong, you don't like to bring it up, but I mean, you have an ongoing relationship with Warren Buffett as well then.
Well, I view him really, after my parents, and one's parents are always one's great teachers in life, but beyond him, I mean, beyond my parents, I'd say it's Warren Buffett and a certain professor who's now a professor at Georgetown, a law professor named David Luban, and his wife were also sort of the college professors who took me under the wings. But Buffett, in the course of a dozen conversations, my parents let me skip school and just hang out with him in the afternoon, and he would sit and talk to me. And I look back, the whole course of my life deflected 30 or 40 degrees.
Right. I mean, I do bring it up as well. I think it's important for some of the stuff we'll get to later about your take on the financial markets, just to let people know that, I mean, you're kind of raised in this background and with people who know what's going on in the financial markets. I think it'll lend a little bit of context.
Oh, yeah. My family was kind of funny. When friends would come over, they would be kind of amazed. We were 15, 16. My father was teaching us about bonds and stuff over there. So we just grew up I wouldn't say a Wall Street environment. We never lived in Wall Street, but we got very familiar with and with the workings of American financial markets.
Right. You know, maybe should we jump from Centricate to kind of the next venture, which I don't know if I'm going to say it right or if this was the exact next venture, but Fetchheimer?
Yes, that's the correct the German pronunciation is Fetchheimer, but it's the American is Fetchheimer, which Mr. Buffett owned.
So that was a Berkshire Hathaway company. And so you were CEO and chairman and president at Centricate. And then, well, so how did you make the flip to the next?
Mr. Buffett's had I don't know if he would want me to say it was a troubled property, but it was a dicey situation. It was the summer of 1997, and I had agreed with my old Chinese teacher that I was in the summer of 1999 going to take some Dartmouth students over to China. But Mr. Buffett called me out to Omaha. I went out, and he said, would you step in as CEO of this? There was a union battle going on. There were different things. So I did. It was supposed to be, I think, a three to six month assignment, and it went on for about 20 months.
And according to always reliable Wikipedia, this company manufactured police, firefighter, and military uniforms. Did Wikipedia get that one?
They got that one right.
That's kind of interesting. Obviously, Warren Buffett kind of dabbles in all kinds of weird stuff.
I mean, he's gone through different phases in building Berkshire Hathaway, but one phase was accumulating a wonderful set of old line American companies that you don't think of as being super sexy or anything, but he's really the natural buyer out there for any family owned business in America that reaches a certain size. They don't want to take it public. They don't want to see it gobbled up by some conglomerate. Buffett is the natural buyer. He'll pay a fair price. He won't pay a ridiculous price, but he'll pay a fair price, and your company can become part of his stable of operating companies. And he's unique in that he's not going to send a bunch of he provides a great out for families which own businesses that don't quite know what to do with them as the managing generation is reaching retirement.
Right.
Well, I think you've also gone so far as to say that calling Buffett a genius businessman sort of misses the point, that he's more than a businessman. I think you described it as sort of someone who has figured out, you know, the underpinnings of life, and he's chosen to apply that to the business world.
Absolutely.
But it goes much further than that.
Absolutely. In fact, there's a wonderful book by Roger Lowenstein, a former Wall Street Journal reporter, that made that point. It's called Buffett, the Making of an American Capitalist, that what he really is a, you'd say, a philosopher. Buffett would say his but his partner, Charlie Munger, is his private philosopher. But Buffett and Munger, they figured out these underlying principles that aren't really just about business. They're about life. And they acted by them, and it's worked out very well. And Buffett insists over and over that it's really very simple, and people make things much more complicated than they have to be.
Right. Tell us about this Munger speech that you're so enamored of that you sent out to all your friends.
You've really done your homework. I was on an airplane once, and I used to carry these big stacks of reading materials, and I'd fall behind. And I came across this speech. I think it was reprinted in something called OID. It was a speech Munger had given at the UCLA Law School. And it was, they asked him to talk about stock picking. And he had shown up and said, I'm going to talk about stock picking as a subdivision of the elementary art of worldly wisdom. I'm going to tell you how to be wise. And then once you're wise, you can just apply it to picking stocks or whatever. And he gave this phenomenal talk that about how wisdom is having a proper set of mental models to which you can aggregate information. And the problem with American higher education is often that you get one professor who's flailing away on one model. They're trying to make everything fit that model, but the real wisdom comes from having a couple dozen different models. And so some of them are like from biology, from understanding evolutionary theory, understanding equilibrium. The Marxist model is actually a valid model and works for some types of evidence and such. So he gave this beautiful talk, and it was so remarkable. I landed, and probably violating a bunch of copyright laws, I called my assistant and said, you've got to get this article, and I want you to make 50 copies. And I'd written out 50 people I wanted it sent to, and I mailed it to all these people. And about 2 months later, I discovered Mr. Buffett sent it out to 10,000 Berkshire Hathaway shareholders. Obviously, he was impressed in the same way I had been.
I love it.
It's a tremendous, tremendous speech. It's like changes people's lives when they read it.
Have you read that yet?
I have not, clearly. No,
yeah, most definitely. Can you walk us then from this? You said this was meant to be a 6-month thing. How long did it?
Lasted just short of 2 years. Just short of 2 years. And then I went off to, I left that company. And I actually retired. By that time, I had a pretty good nest egg. Enough that I could go on. I really didn't see myself as a business guy for the rest of my life. And I went off to China with a bunch of Dartmouth students. And while I was in China, this idea, actually just before I left China, this idea came along. It was really about the flea market industry. And it was about how the flea market industry worked and how the supply side of the flea market industry worked. And I really read this. And during the internet bubble, I still had this company on the side that was a small, my investment holding company. And I was a small staff there and a partner there. And they were vetting dozens, if not hundreds, of ideas that came across the transom. And this one idea came, and it took 5 minutes, probably not even 5 minutes, before I realized this could be a great internet business.
You know, I saw in an interview you gave about kind of your battles with cancer, you said that your ideal would be to be walking on a trail with a backpack. I think you said that kind of held all your possessions, and that was the only thing you think about. So here you are, you've got enough money to do that if you want to, but yet, you know, you said that people keep dragging you back in, but I mean, more or less, you kind of dragging yourself back into this one.
I've kept everything I own down to a bare minimum still, and everything I own fits in a nice size apartment. And I have in Salt Lake City. I'm feeling terribly bourgeois because my whole life I've lived with a dream of getting everything down to a backpack. As you mentioned, I never even owned a car that I spent more than about $4,000 or $5,000 on. My dream was just to get everything into the trunk at least. In the last few years, I got a nice loft, and now I have sofas and stuff, and I'm feeling terribly adult. But anyway, so what was the question?
Well, so, I mean, you know, you said if you had your druthers, you'd just take off. But, I mean, really, you had that opportunity, and you came back and started another company.
I did. Yeah. Okay. Guilty as charged.
So you have no explanation.
I thought I was going to do it for about 6 months and then drift off again.
Okay. Okay.
That's what I thought I was doing.
Well, we should – you mentioned this. It's the height of the dot-com bubble, right? You approached, I think it was 55 VCs with this idea at the height of the dot-com bubble, and all 55 rejected you?
This was when kids were dropping out of Stanford Business School, and with a one-page business plan, they'd go in for a wedding registry, you know, idea, and they get $40 million. And I'd run a couple companies. I'd worked for Mr. Buffett. I thought that, boy, I'm going to be a shoo-in to get money. And I went around to 55 different venture capitalists on Sand Hill Road in the Bay Area, and all 55 turned me down, which tells you what a lousy salesman I am.
Do you think that's what it was? What do you think it was?
There was clearly a – and I don't mean to diss – there's some very good venture capitalists and some very good thinkers. The guys at Benchmark stand out in my mind. There's a guy at Sequoia, Michael, the Welsh fellow, who's actually an ex-journalist that Bill Hamburg. Anyway, so there's some very good venture capitalists. But in general, to be honest, what I got out of a lot of them was this sense of, we're not here to build a real business. They want to find something where let me stick some money in today that's going to be hot in 6 months so I can flip out of it. So it's the exact antithesis of the value approach. And the value approach, one of these lessons that I mentioned Buffett told me when I was a kid was, he said, you buy a share of stock if and only if you were going to buy it, even if the market were going to shut down for 10 years tomorrow. Would you buy that? So that gets you don't think of it anymore as a piece of paper that's bouncing around. You think of it as a slice of a business with a real value, and do you want to own that for 10 years? Well, if you take that mentality into a startup, and typically value investing doesn't get into startups because it's all too speculative and such, but if you get into an entrepreneurial situation and you have that mentality and somebody's sitting there saying, okay, I'll put money in, but the first thing you're going to do is buy a whole bunch of advertising on Excite.com because then you'll get these eyeballs, and then we'll get money 6 months from now at this valuation, and then once we get that, we'll buy more advertising, we'll get, you know, more eyeballs, and then we'll get more money in, then we flip at a higher valuation, then we can flip it to the public. They're all just speaking Greek. It doesn't make any sense from a value perspective. The value perspective is, you build a company from scratch as if you're not going to ever sell it. There is no exit strategy. The exit strategy is get building a great company. So I think that the problem was that about 53 out of the 55 venture capitalists just spoke a different language. And it could have been and we could have been deceitful and gone along with it and said and pretended to speak their language. But as soon as we were honest about how we wanted to do things and they were honest, people pretty much lost interest. There was some underhanded stuff too, I'll tell you if you want. But
but also, I mean, just to take that analogy further, you are sort of the yin to their yang. So the bubble bursts, okay? All these companies that these VCs have funded start going out of business. You start grabbing, you know, their merchandise, right?
Right.
And start selling it on your site.
We liquidated 18 companies funded by the same guys who had turned us down for money. I'm much too mature, Cade, to take any pleasure in that, I promise.
I'm sure. I'll take some pleasure in it.
I was on ABC did a story about us. Chris Cuomo asked me, how do you feel about doing it? I said, hey, the first rule of – my papa always taught me the first rule of business is, if you're not going to kick a man when he's down, when are you going to kick him?
So, baby, you got Overstock funded. How many – this was your venture. How many core people were behind it at the beginning? Like, I guess, how many people were on your team?
In terms of employees of the company?
Yeah, that you initially started with doing Overstock.
There was this company that we basically bought a majority share in that was called Discounts Direct, that had been around since 97, that was supplying people in the flea market industry. And it was on a fax broadcast model, but they were on the verge. They couldn't make payroll. So we stepped in. There were about 20 people in the company then. I mean, we funded it, and it was October 99. We launched the website, Overstock.com.
Okay. And then WorldStock, did that launch immediately with Overstock?
No, that was 2001.
Do us a favor and just explain WorldStock real quick.
Real quick, single best idea of my life. I've got to take a step to explain something about Overstock. Overstock's niche is this. The American retail system is set up for mass quantities of identical goods. So when Overstocks become available, 200 of this, 20 of that, 50 of that, it doesn't work in normal retail. The supply chain's optimized around different parameters. Well, in 2001, I was over in Cambodia, and I had been there some years before, and I wanted to see how Cambodia turned out. I was motorcycling around Cambodia, and Cambodia has the largest or second largest number of landmine survivors in the world, and so a lot of people missing arms or legs and such, and they get retrained as potters and weavers and silversmiths. And they made these beautiful goods, but I realized it couldn't work in mass retail because this artisan production is very small lot. And then I realized, wait, we had just spent 2 years, 3 years building the most perfect supply chain to deal with artisan small lot production. So we opened a store within Overstock called WorldStock the point of which was to carry artisan goods from around the world, to really sell them with the most minimal markup so we could keep the prices low, generate a lot of business for these artisans and employ as many people as possible and raise their, you know, basically the idea is to triple their income.
And how's WorldStock doing today?
It's actually just, it had a dip just like the rest of the company from 2005, 6, and 7. We sort of came off the rails and we've gotten back on the rails rather nicely. And Overstock is now being managed by a wonderful gal named Angela Ramirez. Who's from Colombia, and it's great. We have 35 countries. We have about 5,000 or 6,000 people, artisans making their living from it. It did about $15-16 million, I think, last year. It's growing quickly. There was a time a few years ago I got an award from the government of Afghanistan because we were the largest employer for 1 year, the largest employer in Afghanistan.
Without selling opium.
Yeah, I have to say you're sitting with a Jack Welch of Afghanistan. We had 1,500 employees, 1,300 of them women.
How's your golf game?
Not good. Never played. Without selling opium, yeah.
So, you know, I don't know if the ads ran internationally, but I imagine, I mean, Overstock was doing well, but I imagine a lot of people might have run into Overstock for the first time through the very famous, the Big O ads where you guys had, you know, we have a lot of international listeners. So you had a very attractive woman talking about the Big O, and it was kind of going after the female market more or less. And these kind of everything in the ads were white, and it was almost like a cult kind of character. You ran the ads on the Super Bowl 1 year, I think. Yeah. So is that when, am I wrong, or is that, I mean, that ad campaign was very effective. Is that when Overstock really started to?
Well, the ad campaign was a phenomenon for us. We had been growing very well, but then that just took us into the next, to the next level. That was Sabina Ehrenfeld. She's a lovely woman from Germany. There's a funny story behind that I've never told publicly.
Here we go.
We tried work. I've got this fabulous woman who as a colleague. Her name's Stormy Simon. I like to call her she doesn't mind me saying, she's my own Erin Brockovich. She's a gal from Tooele, Utah. She walked in one day as a temporary worker through a temp agency, and within about 6 months had 150 people reporting her. She's just completely capable, the most capable. She's just a little spitfire, and we fight a lot, actually. We disagree a lot. But she just stands her ground, and she's great, and she succeeds. She built our BMMG business. She built our B2B business. She writes all our ads. She wrote those ads. She produces them, and she buys all the airtime for them. She's a one-woman ad agency. We actually tried working with three or four different advertising agencies. And what was funny was, and there's a little business lesson here, that we had 68 different television ideas presented to us. They were things like, okay, this guy's going to be in an office and something happens and he runs and somebody opens a file drawer and he smashes his head into it and falls. And she would say, look at this ad. Office Depot just did this. And so each one of these 68 ideas, we just realized how incredibly derivative it is to work with most advertising agencies. No originality. An ad would be something like, okay, a guy is very mopey and he's raining on him and he's just very, very sad. And then at the very end of the ad, he discovers Overstock and he's happy. Well, you realize that ad you could do about Burger King, you could do about anything. It really had nothing to do with Overstock, and what he was a frustrated Fellini wannabe director in Hollywood. So we just came up with this idea of let's have this mature, late 30s, sexually confident, sexually assertive brunette, so it's not some waifish little blonde or something. And we looked for her for about 2 or 3 months, and Stormy found her. And when she did, we have a wonderful director named Paul Dechter in Hollywood, and we have no ad agency, and no one's ever worked like this, we're told. Stormy just went down. We actually met Sabina, sat getting to know her and stuff, and then sat with a typewriter, typed up the script. Literally, Stormy just sat there on set that morning, you know, typing up the script and working with a timing person and such until we got the right 25 seconds, and then they shot it. In that afternoon, and that ad became this phenomenon. So Stormy still does all of our television advertising.
Right. But you guys don't run those particular ones anymore, really. I mean, I feel like I see them on and off and on again.
Well, we don't run Sabina as right. much. I'll give you something that nobody knows yet. You'll like this. You'll like this story. Sabina was fantastic about, you know, she's so alluring and she's one of the most, you know, anyway.
What adjective are you looking for
there? Well, not one I'm going to say, except this isn't on air. I can say anything I want. Right? Anyway, she's a wonderful woman, but she was perfect for, they teach in marketing, the first phase is creating awareness. So she created the awareness, but now we're getting to the phase of explaining the virtues and the features and getting understanding and loyalty. And we decided to, well, Sabina actually worried that she was getting too typecast. She's an actress in Hollywood and didn't want to spend the rest of her life being the O-girl. So it was very mutual. She sort of went her way. And we found another actress. Her name is Brianna Walker. She's the blonde. Actually, Stormy also for about 6 months has been doing our ads, and the brunette you see in our ads is actually Stormy. But we have a new woman. She's a blonde. Have you noticed these ads?
You know, I have to confess, I used to have cable TV and everything. I'm shameful. I don't even have I don't have cable. My bunny ears barely work. I don't watch a lot of TV these days.
Well, we have this wonderful young woman doing our advertisements now. She's been advertising for the Valentine's Day promotion. Her name is Brianna Walker. And if you dig in with this is probably another story. If you dig in with your investigative journalism capabilities, you'll find some interesting things about this that story. I won't tell you any more than that.
There we go. So Overstock is this online retailer, and I think just after Patrick and I had our customer service encounter, that's when I started listening to Overstock.com earnings calls, and I got to say, you guys have the best earning calls going. I give Patrick credit because, especially in the game that Kate and I do, I mean, most CEOs get on the line and they, you know, it's just like listening to a politician speak, and they can have six disastrous quarters in a row and still just get on there, and the analysts will say, you know, when is the blood going to stop pouring? And they say, everything's going fine. You know,
we're pleased with our progress this quarter.
Exactly. So if you haven't listened to an Overstock earnings call, Patrick does not do that at all. When things go well, he says why they're going well, and when they go bad, he gets into the gory details about why they go bad. And as you can imagine, as much as you'd think an analyst would kind of want that kind of upfrontness, a lot of people on Wall Street react negatively to this whole approach because they think you're probably sharing a little too much.
Tell you where it came from. Before our first quarterly letter, I think it was, just after we had gone public, I called Mr. Buffett and asked for his advice. He said, look, always think of your shareholders like your mom. If there's a bunch of moms out there, would you feel if your mom owned your business that you were running, what would you feel that it was fair to share with her and to explain with her? And that's how, you know, that's what you owe your shareholders. So I just started writing these long quarterly letters that were just, in fact, I took the letters that I had given to the board of directors explaining what had gone good and bad, or well and poorly, I suppose, since I'm with.
You are a philosophy major.
Well, in your journal, you're a wordsmith. So, and I would write, I took those board letters and I sanitized them a bit from personal details and such, and I gave them to the shareholders. Well, it was kind of funny that I thought that analysts would appreciate it, and then I would have conference calls with shareholders and the analysts, and I just would answer questions. And everybody thought, and you're exactly right, most CEOs say it's just pap after pap after pap. It's, oh, we're so pleased with the progress this quarter. I told the people who were involved in issuing our press releases and first started drafting for me that don't ever put, I mean, it's like a cause for termination. Do not ever put a sentence in my mouth that's pap. Any one of these, we're so pleased with our progress this quarter. And you're right. If things are going well, the CEOs say everything's super de duper. And if things are going badly, they just say everything's just super. And so I said, no, when things are going well, I'm going to say, hey, we are, you know, things are going well. And I always try to give credit to the colleagues of mine who are responsible. When things go badly, I always try to take the blame and apologize and own it. It didn't endear me. In fact, there's this expression, your earnings, did you make your numbers or something? And we've had earnings. I mean, people were wrong. We had one quarter of GAAP net income. We had years of cash flow positive and free cash flow. And we've had several quarters of a positive operating income. But if we would miss our earnings by a penny, and there really was this one time we had missed our earnings, like the street was expecting, say, 10 cents and we had 9 cents. And literally an analyst called us and said, "You idiots, don't you know you're supposed to change a reserve, or now it's $100,000. You could change a reserve or do anything you want to get that extra penny, so you would have made your earnings." I mean, it's not only ridiculous that he would think that, it's ridiculous he would call and suggest that to us. Do you realize how crazy that is?
Oh, of course.
I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous, right? I mean, you're supposed to do what all these analysts are predicting that you're doing. I mean, the whole notion is ridiculous.
I've never looked at any of their stuff once. I mean, there's some good analysts in terms of a business sense, but we don't have any sense of, we're supposed to make, you know, X many cents this quarter or something. Right. We just never think that way.
Right. The funny thing about it, too, is that, you know, you get on these analyst calls and they try to be kind of like journalists sometimes. It's like, you know, they're really digging in to get, it's like, but, you know, where did these sales go? And the CEO kind of fights them and they're like, try to ask the question in a different way. And here's Patrick. He actually gives you all the information. They're like, no, we don't want to hear it that much, man.
You should have said it this way. They call afterwards. You should have said it this way. It's crazy.
Yeah.
But some of them are good. I don't mean to, there's some good analysts.
Of course there are. But, you know, in my experience, especially in the tech game, it's like, just the guys don't seem to do a lot of research or really know the business. They don't know the nitty gritty stuff about the companies they cover, which, maybe they have to cover too many, or maybe they're too busy. I don't know, but it seems a little shit. The guys who are good, they know in 1 second they hear something new and they realize all the kind of ramifications of it and can dig in and ask really good questions. But it's like any profession.
Well, we gave up years ago. There were times we had fabulous quarters that blew away what everybody was thinking was going to happen. And our stock would crash, and there were quarters where we thought were horrible, and it would go up, and people would be happy with us. So we just gave up trying to predict it. In fact, before we went public, it was grounds for termination to discuss going public, and since we've been public, it's grounds for termination to discuss the stock price. You cannot discuss the stock price with an Overstock.
Right. You know, Patrick, we've been talking a lot about your life, and we've gotten up to Overstock.com, which is your main business now. Can you just give us real quick a scope of the size of Overstock, where you fit in, and just give us the revenue real quick, and then where you fit in among the big online retailers?
Well, our traffic is in the top five of the online e-tailers. I think we're the second pure play to Amazon general merchandiser. We grew to 800 million, from 2 million to 800 million in 5 years. We've been stuck for, I think, 3 years now at that 800 million number. And we're just starting to see, we came off the rails, and when we've just been kind of stuck there as we fix the business. And we think we see some growth returning now.
And when you talk about coming off the rails, we did a story about this on the Register a little bit, but I mean, a lot of it was a technology, it was a back end thing that you guys have since solved.
Yeah. We built on such a shoestring, and I'm not, you know, this is one of those times where I can explain it. I'll take all the fault, totally my fault. And guys who don't like me will go out there and say, Bird's making excuses. And I'm saying, no, I take all responsibility. I totally screwed up, but if you want to know how I screwed up, this is how. We built on such a shoestring. We were a $500 million company running on a computer that would fit under your desk. I mean, when real serious guys from Silicon Valley would come out and would see how we were operating, they just said, you're completely nuts. We built the company. We reached, I think, 800 million on, or 500 million of revenue on $68 million of burn capital, and we're generating positive cash flow. In comparison, Amazon lost about $3.5 billion before they got positive cash flow. And we kept doubling. And reached the point, it was like Star Trek, where, you know, divert all emergency power to the shields. We were literally turning off parts of our site and running things at night instead of the day and stuff, just to keep the site alive. So we went out and we were overly ambitious. We realized rather belatedly that we had driven down a cul-de-sac, and we had to go out and invest. And we ended up being about $75, $85 million on big enterprise class systems: Oracle, Teradata, EMC. I'm sure I'm leaving out some big ones. Oracle, ERP. And the, not only was it too much to do, and we basically did three 18-month projects in one 8-month period, and the wheels came off. And that's when you called and ordered your MP3 player.
Now the goal is to get above this $800 million mark. But in the background, everyone, buckle up, because here we go. You know, in the background of all this, you've done nothing short of the most unusual step for a CEO, which is basically suing all of Wall Street, more or less, or at least some major players on Wall Street.
Did you say short?
Give us so when I called, you guys were in the midst of digging into what you've pretty much portrayed as kind of a conspiracy against Overstock. So give us the short version of, and then we'll dig in. Give us the short version of what you guys saw was going on.
And I think I should mention one other, going back just one step. We actually reached the point where we were were marginally profitable, where we had, or for the an annual basis, I think minus 0.5 or 0.8%. We're back at the point where we're generating good positive cash flow and such. So we've come out of the woods. We've come out of those dark days,
it feels to me. So
when
you went public, and that was when, end of 2004?
2002, actually.
Oh, I'm sorry. 2002. Prior to this controversy, January 2005, you were cash flow positive.
Yeah.
Okay.
And GAAP net income positive and app operating income and such.
Okay.
And even when we were, even though for the year we were GAAP net income negative, I think it was 0.5%. People would say, oh, they weren't profitable. Well, we were within 0.5% of profitability, and we were generating $20 million of positive cash flow and such. So we were okay. I had drawn the wrath. I went public with the Hambrecht Dutch auction, the thing that Google did later. Right. We did 2 years earlier. And I was told that if you do this, you'll be the pariah of Wall Street for the rest of your life if you do this. And in fact, we had lots of big banks wanted to do our IPO. And they all said, you know, I'll work, bank X says I'll work with Y, and Y says I'll work with Z, and Z says I'll work with that. But they all said, we will not work with Hambrecht. Well, I'm a child of the 60s, and it's like I was taught in the 60s, if you have a friend and then who's African American, and your other friends say, oh, no, you can't bring him around. Your duty is to be friends then with him. So all these other banks were saying, the one bank we won't work with is with Hambrecht. Well, that made my decision for me. Plus the Hambrecht Dutch auction, the normal IPO system is a totally corrupt system that rips off the American people. No one should ever take part in a normal IPO. No retail investor should ever participate. The only fair IPOs are Dutch auctions.
So explain to our listeners here, so why were they so opposed to it?
Because they have a system for extracting wealth away from the American. The IPO process, the conventional IPO process, is a way basically of extracting wealth from the American people. They transfer to crony hedge funds, who then give a kickback. The traditional kickback's 30%. In tech industry, it's 40%. Frank Quattrone, CSFB, was caught on tape, one of his guys saying, you know, Frank's deals are 50%. Everybody knows it. I can explain it with a pencil and paper and such, but anybody who's on Wall Street past the age of 30 sort of gets lit in on this secret. And the basic secret is, suppose you have a Mercedes that's worth $20,000 and you ask me to go sell it for you. And I go and sell it. And instead of getting $20,000, I sell it to Ashley for $8,000. And then you find out that Ashley and I are friends. Not only are we friends, but a week later I went over to Ashley's house and I mowed his grass, and he paid me $6,000 to mow his grass. It's pretty clear what happened. I just, you know, Ashley made the $12,000 that I deliberately underpriced the product, and he gave me a kickback of 50% on it. That's how IPOs work. And anybody with an economic sense, when you saw these IPOs, stocks coming out at 15 and going to 60, anyone with an economic sense had to understand there was some misprice to begin with. And then there's other techniques involved called laddering and such, that where they make it worse and worse. And it's a very formal system. It's kept – there's something within the investment banks called an allocation desk where all this is tracked, all the favors. It's tracked who is owed, who made what, and what kickback is owed. So it's an incredibly corrupt system. I was actually friends with Milton Friedman. He passed away 15 months ago. And one of the things we talked about was this, and he couldn't believe. He had pioneered bringing Dutch auctions. A Dutch auction eliminates all that. See, the basic problem is, as a general rule of human affairs, anytime somebody's in a position to allocate guaranteed profit, they're in a position to extract kickback. Doesn't matter if you're talking about some Afghani customs agent or a Goldman Sachs white shoe lawyer, a white shoe banker. If you're in a position to allocate guaranteed profit, which in the internet bubble, the bankers were in the position to do, they're going to get kickbacks.
Right. Now, that said, you would argue that there's a much larger problem as well.
So that was all small potatoes. But I went with Hambrecht on principle. So about 2 or 3 years later, some people started getting in touch with me. So that was all.
Obviously, we're going to go into naked shorting here. So maybe it would help if we just sort of briefly explained that concept.
Yeah.
You can do that, or I can do that. Or
okay. Well, about 3 years later, some people started getting in touch with me and telling me and asking me to take on this issue of naked shorting in the American capital markets. And I'll give a crack at – why don't you give a crack at explaining, and then I'll
– okay. Well, I think some readers may be familiar with a short sale, which is when I borrow stock from Patrick and then I sell it to Ashley with the anticipation the price is going to go down. Then once the price does go down, I buy it back. I give it back to you. I've made a profit. With a naked short sale, I do much the same thing, except I don't really borrow the stock from you. Okay. Now, you could argue this is, in essence, creating stock that doesn't exist.
Correct.
Okay. And I think people, a good analogy here is counterfeit money. It's not necessarily analogous, but I mean, it's a good way to describe it. By creating counterfeit money, you're driving down the price of the dollar. And that is what you're arguing is going on here.
Right. And so that's a beautiful explanation. Now, let me come at it from a slightly different angle. And this angle says, in a normal stock transaction, you give me money and I give you stock. That's called settlement. In, believe it or not, in the United States, and this is hard for people to believe, there's loopholes that say when the time comes for me to give you the stock that you bought, if I don't have it, I can actually create what's called an FTD, a failure to deliver. It's an IOU for the stock that I sold you. Now, you never know that I never gave you stock, because you still get your Merrill Lynch brokerage statement that says you got this stock, but no stock actually ever came. And so now you and I can't take advantage of this, but big hedge funds and the prime brokers, Morgan, Goldman, Bear, they can take advantage of these loopholes.
Right. And whether or not they are or not, okay, I mean, it should be pointed out that the fact of the matter is that there are $6 billion in trades every day
there's
a failure to deliver.
Right.
Okay, so in essence, the stock is being traded and the stock isn't there.
And that $6 billion isn't a whole number. And you never – well, it actually creates three classes of problems, a small and a medium and a large. The small problem is it's destroying corporate governance, corporate voting, because there's all this fake stock, hundreds of millions of shares, actually over a billion fake shares, these IOUs. You never know that you got a fake share, that it never arrived. You're sent a proxy for your shares so you can vote. You don't understand that your vote's just getting thrown out when it gets in. In fact, Bloomberg did an amazing story about a year and a half ago, a piece by Bob Drummond called The Corporate Voting Charade, that said just that he had on the record quotes from backroom, the guys at the transfer agents who count the votes in corporate elections, that say, and these folks saying, it's positively criminal, this direct quote, we regularly get 2 to 3 times as many votes as there are shares. And there's no rules about which votes they count. So big corporate decisions are actually getting made by some guy in the back office, not by shareholders, but by people deciding which votes to turn a threat. That's the small problem. The mid problem, and the one that I would think would concern your tech listeners, it's been amazing how hard I thought that the tech industry would get this. The kinds of you can destroy companies. You use the term counterfeit currency. This is like temporary counterfeit currency. It's supposed to be temporary. You're supposed to use these rules just for, you know, a few days, these exceptions.
And there are cases where this is legitimate, right? Clerical errors,
yes,
et cetera, where, you know, there will be a failure to deliver, and that's not a problem.
Correct. And that's why they put the loopholes in the regulation. So if somebody failed to deliver, the system wouldn't just seize, that there would be, it wouldn't freeze up. There would be a way to handle it as somebody straightened out whatever clerical error they made. But what's happened is these failures are persisting now for months and even years. And the SEC hired an economist named Leslie Boni, who studied it and showed if it were random human error, it would be spread across the market like peanut butter across a sandwich. But it isn't. It's very, very concentrated, which shows it's not random human error. It's people deliberately ganging up and doing this to crack the market in particular companies' stock.
And we should say that you believe that Overstock is one of these companies.
I actually do everything I can to divorce this from Overstock. I've said, forget Overstock. We have this systemic problem. It's The Economist did a story a little over a year ago about the American capital market used to have 57% of the global capital formation. And capital formation is a very good health of the measure of the health of an economy. In 7 years ago, we had 57%. It's down to 16%. A company that lost that market share, 57 to 16 in 6 or 7 years, would be a disaster. This comes up a lot in tech and biotech. I don't meet a biotech CEO who does not know about this problem. They're going to Singapore to go public, Japan, London, India. It's you're nuts if you go public into this market. Unless you have a company that already has a very strong cash flow, you can't go public into this market because they can destroy it. Let me give you just a quick example. There's a company called Force Protection. Force Protection is a $200 million company, made $18 million GAAP net income last year, very nice $30, $40 million cash flow. They make what are called MRAPs, these V-shaped hull mine-resistant vehicles that soldiers are using in Iraq and Afghanistan. They can't keep up with production. The Army ordered 10,000, the Marines ordered 3,500. They can't possibly keep up with production. They decided to sell some of their stock, which was trading at 30 bucks a share, to raise capital, expand their factories so they could keep up with the DOD's orders. Their stock got naked shorted from $30 down to $4. They had to cancel their secondary. As a result of that, they didn't get the capital, couldn't expand their production, which means that somewhere in Iraq, some American soldiers are going to die this week. So some hedge fund so-and-so could drive a new Ferrari. It's that simple. That's really what's going on. Now, that's all, believe it or not, that's the middle problem. That's the medium-sized problem. The big problem is there's good evidence that there may be more of these fake shares in the system than there is the liquidity to clean it up, in which case we're going to have a financial collapse. Now, I've been saying for 3 years. 3 years ago, I came out and said, hedge funds have figured out a way to rip off pension funds. The Wall Street banks are helping them. The SEC is more co-opted than an Afghani customs agent. And it's all going to end in a huge systemic failure. And from the moment I said that, I became this crazy, crazy CEO. Oh, he's just mad his own stock price went down. First of all, I've been saying this when our stock price was soaring. I've said it when it collapsed. I've said it when it goes sideways. But forget Overstock. We got this massive social problem. And to me, the cover-up has been, this is just Patrick Byrne's just mad about his own company. So that may be a longer defensive explanation.
That works. But, I mean, some people do. Like, I've got a banker friend. So you just pointed to one company where all the financials are pretty straightforward and this is happening to them. But, you know, my friend, he's a pretty level-headed guy, and he says that you do bring this on yourself just because – he says, you know, you look at most companies where they're making a profit and the revenues are increasing. Nobody's going to do this. You know, why don't these companies seem to face these issues? Like, basically, if your house is in order, you're fine.
It's like saying, Judge, yeah, we raped her, but she was wearing a red dress and walking through Central Park in the middle of the night. You know, she brought it on herself. You can't go into a hospital pneumonia ward, leave the window, you know, smother some patients and say, they were probably going to die anyway. There's an economist, very serious economist named Robert Shapiro, Harvard economist. He was actually Bill Clinton's economist. He was on the National Council and such. And he estimates several thousand companies. And by the way, the companies destroyed or attacked by this overwhelmingly tend to be tech and biotech and small financial companies. And several thousand companies, hundreds of billions of dollars drained out of the system. And as he puts it, you know, some of those companies would have died anyway. Some of them wouldn't. It's not up to stock manipulators to decide that. It's up to the market. And the most amazing thing is that the SEC has been just is hapless. And I should, I was told, by the way, that when I'm sorry, I'll stop there.
Go ahead. No, you were told.
I was told that I was going to, if I came out and did this, somebody told me these people are incredibly vindictive. They're going to come after you. I came out and started saying all this. Within several months, I became the object of a SEC investigation. I'm happy. I've said many times on the radio, please come after me, SEC. I'll meet the SEC in any court in the land, and I will put them on trial. I think they're a corrupt organization. I don't think they should survive. I think the SEC should be dismembered and become an office within the DOJ.
Even if you believed that we were heading to a financial crisis, don't you think it undermines your position when you come out and say stuff like that? People say, you know, who is this doom? And nobody wants to hear that. You say it in very passionately. Some people would say, well, this guy's, look at him.
He's just a Sith Lord example.
He's kind of obsessed by this.
Isn't that ill-advised, maybe?
I said it gently for about 9 months, and nobody would pay any attention. See, there's really been, before me, I'm just, there's a dozen people, really. Figured a guy, David Falk, Mark Patch, an anonymous guy named Bob O'Brien, who's on the lam somewhere in South America to keep the mob from whacking him. I mean, there's strange guys out there who've put all this together within social media. They could all just be dismissed as, they're just crazy, crazy, crazy. They're just folks who are mad their stock went down. And nobody could penetrate the discourse. I tried, got nowhere. So eventually I had a death threat is what I've never come out and said all this, but eventually I had to start taking warnings with my life, precautions with my life. And I took, so I scheduled this. I went off the grid for about 3 weeks and I scheduled this new web conference. And went on and said, there's this, the famous miscreants ball call, where I said, there's this massive crime going on against the American people. I'm going to name names. I named how it's happening, how it's working. I said, all these guys are going to come out and say they're going to sue me. None of them are going to sue me because they can't take discovery. And I did that in part as a prophylactic against, once I had done that, I felt it gave me some,
sticking with that call, I mean, coming out is one thing, but when you start saying that there's a Sith Lord out there, don't you realize that you may be going too far? And that whether or not you have a point, people are going to call you crazy.
Well, to me, have you actually read the transcript of the call?
It's funny.
Yeah.
It's the transcript, you know, at the end of an hour-long call, I said, you know, I have the sense that this is not some random thing going on, that there's somewhere out there, there's somebody working on, you know, some Sith Lord who's actually organizing this. Well, you know, that's all I said. And it became, this guy, you know, crazy, crazy here. Well, it's not. I'll give you an example, if I can be frank, since you're bringing it up. I gave this example, and I'll use it. I told this story that I became evidence accrued that I was being wiretapped. And so I worked out something with a lady friend that said about that we would discuss cocaine. Now, I chose cocaine because I've never even seen cocaine in my life, except with, I saw it, never touched it, but once when I was a teenager, I saw it. So I knew that if I put this out there and then anything started coming back that we had, she was burgled and different things happened that suggested she was being listened to on her end. So I put this out there and within 2 or 3 months, somebody got in touch with me, my old thesis advisor, to say, I got this very strange call from somebody claiming to be doing research on you and wants to know if you were a cocaine abuser. Well, so that's the story I told. And if I can be frank, the journalists took that as, this guy's crazy. That there's talking about whether they never told what the real story was that I said. They just went out and said, this guy's talking all about cocaine on conference calls. Why is he doing that? So I did this call that the whole point was to shock and punch through the discourse. But I thought that what we had were a few corrupt journalists in the business press. And I thought that by putting some stuff out there, by seeing how they reported on it, it would be my shibboleth to figure out who was honest and who wasn't. Well, this set of financial journalists who are the same ones who always seem to be carrying the water for this small set of hedge funds, all came out and reported on it exactly the same way. Not one of them, for example, in that case, gave the backstory, explained what I really had been saying.
Okay, but one argument here is that that's how journalists behave ordinarily in large respect. Right?
Then why are you pointing at me?
Huh?
Then why point at me?
Okay. Journalists tend to write what other journalists write. I mean, that's just the way it works. No?
Well, especially if the people didn't listen to the transcripts, I mean, or read the transcripts. I thought it was great stuff, but I was on a different mission. I was exacting revenge for my MP3 player. So.
Okay. My impression of journalists was actually, and it still is, but it was very positive until that moment. I did not see it that way. And I know that a lot of people, you know, diss journalists. I used to always go around saying it's not at all like it is in Hollywood. I mean, when I first, say from 2000 to 2005, I was dealing with the press. And I never met a journalist that I felt was unethical. I never felt I was quoted out of context or anything inappropriate. I had great relationships with journalists, and they were always fair and honest. And then there was this small set that came along and on the hedge fund beat. And I thought it was a very isolated example. I was not aware.
I mean, explain that to me, because as a journalist, I've never been in a newsroom. You know, people probably doubt this, but I mean, people don't sit around and, like, the editors all set some agenda, like, we're going to go get this guy or anything like that. It's kind of like this guy comes up with a story, and it's like, yeah, that's a story you should chase. That's not a story you should chase. In your – what you have described is kind of journalists who are in the pocket – of the hedge fund industry in there, some prominent publications, business publications, online sites. Isn't it a big stretch to imagine that, you know, do you expect these journalists are getting some kind of financial gain from this? Because wouldn't that be the dumbest thing?
First, as a there's a spectrum. I think there's a spectrum. And it's one end of the spectrum. There are good, honest journalists who – I mean, just on the spectrum of the people I'm talking about, there's honest journalists who I think get a little lazy and they wait for the phone to ring. And I'll give you an example. I think Bethany McLean at Fortune is that way. Every single story Bethany McLean has ever written can be traced back to about a half a dozen hedge funds and their positions. So she's a journalist who's just kind of lazy and she waits for the phone to ring. And they give her a story, and she writes it up. There was actually a fellow at the Columbia Journalism Review who investigated and said every single story she's ever written can be traced to the trading positions of half a dozen hedge funds. But it's not, you know, I don't think by any means she takes a payoff. At the other end, at one end. And then there's journalists who sort of get really lazy and get chummy and become poker playing buddies, like Jesse Eisinger of the Wall Street Journal, who is described playing poker with, he's a regular poker playing buddy of these hedge funds. And my guess is they let him win a lot more than the cards really should. And then you move down the ladder, and then there's people who have done nothing. The same CJR, and you know who the CJR is, I assume.
Right.
There's a guy, Herb Greenberg, who's basically his whole career, 20 years, has been reporting basically two hedge funds, that what positions they take are what he puts in his articles. Now, there is a guy named John Deutsch, who's I don't think you can describe him as a fugitive anymore. He spent about 6 months in a Netherlands jail. He's a shady Caribbean financier. He, who's been in and out of trouble with the law, he has described to somebody off who, that I know, who was in the room, who said that he invented something called exact pay cards, which are basically preloaded ATM cards. And, he, according to this source of mine, absolutely said that we're getting, that there's a number of journalists and even a couple SEC officials that we're giving these $10,000, $15,000 preloaded cards too. I can tell you one thing. There's a reporter at the New York Post. Well, he's actually just left and gone to Fortune. His name's Roddy Boyd. That the mere mention of this sends him ballistic in a very unusual way. It's I've never seen anything like it. If you just mention to Roddy Boyd this possibility, he goes absolutely ballistic. And you'll also see that Roddy Boyd has done – so I'm not saying who's been paid and who isn't. I'm just saying – and it isn't even about being paid. It could be as innocent as before I'm old enough to remember Watergate. And in Watergate, you know, it really turned out that what Woodward and Bernstein wrote about, a lot of people knew. But the D.C. press corps had become so chummy with the powers that be, since the days of Kennedy at least, and even Eisenhower, they were so chummy, actually before that – that that it just took two young cub reporters to come along and break a story that people had knew the different pieces of already. Well, there's about the hedge fund beat is really covered by about 20 reporters. About six of them are the significant ones, and they've become extremely chummy with the hedge funds. And where that chumminess ends and where actual, you know, malfeasance begins, I can't say.
So it could just be not financial, but these guys are getting scoops on stuff, or, you know, like any reporter, reporters trade in news and scoops and stuff, so that's worth a lot of capital to a reporter. You get a juicy story here in exchange for writing this story.
It's a favor bank.
Right.
Yeah, deposits get made in favor banks and then they get withdrawn. Although I can tell you that I'll tell this story about this Columbia Journalism Review, now reporter. He was actually the assistant managing editor. He called me to say, when all this started going on, to say, what is this? We're seeing you torn apart like it's 19th century journalism. At the CJR, we can't believe this. And I said, well, you're not going to believe me if I tell you the stories. I'm just going to tell you a little piece of it, and you investigate. And he came back a week later and said, gee, you're right. There is this pattern. And I said, well, how about you look into this and that? After about 6 weeks, he had a experience that I think other people have had of seeing this pattern. And then you just start seeing it becomes so clear what's going on. Now, he had his life threatened. Some three big guys in Armani suits came up to him in a bar and basically, you know, threatened him. By the way, I do have an email. I'll give you a couple examples. And what's happening is any network put under pressure starts having defectors. I have an email from one reporter at a major publication who says exactly what you said doesn't happen. He said the editor came in and said, we are going to take apart Patrick Byrne. We'll look for any dirt. Our new position is now to take this guy apart. And he sent me this from his home email, so it couldn't be picked up. There's somebody at the New York Times who got in touch with me and to say, I just want you to know, Mr. Byrne, that within the New York Times newsroom, I don't want to go into newsroom politics too much, but the word we use is surreal. We think it's absolutely surreal that the New York Times is publishing the articles that Joe Nocera is writing about you. We can't believe the New York Times is publishing this. It's breaking apart. The other journalists are getting that there's something weird going on.
So, well, I've got a hard question for you, because there's a fine line here. You know, I called your offices recently, and that Columbia Journalism Review reporter was at your office. You know, could you argue that maybe you're pretty chummy now with this reporter? And
well,
how is that different?
Well, he disappeared. He disappeared for a year, and then he got in touch with me and said, I want to come out and I want to write this story. I can't move on as a journalist until I write the story of what's going on. So he's out working on a story.
So, I mean, the culmination of some of this was the lawsuit against companies like Merrill Lynch. Was it 13.4 or 3?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you the backstory on this.
Yep.
No one knows this yet.
Okay.
You heard it here first. About a year, just over a year ago, I got a phone call from somebody I'd never met. He said, I need to meet you, Mr. Byrne. And the call got put through. He said some of the right things. So we met in a diner in Long Island. And he is a foreigner, sort of a rough-looking fellow. And he sat down, and I had two people with me. He sat down and he said, look, I've got a very simple message from you. The message is from Russia, and the message is, we're about to kill you. We're about to kill you. In fact, we would normally have just hurt someone close to you by now, but you're so weird, we don't know how you react. So we're about to kill you if you ever mention the words naked shorting again. And it's really that simple.
So come on. I mean, anyone hears that, they'd say, this is crazy.
Well, it is crazy. It's absolutely true. And I'm not going to go into what evidence I have, but there's no...
I think Andrew's point is, whether it's true or not, you saying it on air is going to, you know, have some people calling you crazy.
Well, I am mad north by northwest, but when the wind's from the south, I know a hawk from a handsaw. There's a strategic reason I'm doing that. A short time after that, I said I needed some time to give an answer, and a few days later, somebody threw a 10-inch pair of metal gardening shears through my lady friend's window, her restaurant she runs, and things. And anyway, so eventually, I just took the gloves off, and I filed a $3.5 billion lawsuit against pretty much, as one law professor has called it, Patrick Byrne sues the entire world or something. I'm just going to take, I think our...
It's all the big hedge funds.
It's not all the big hedge funds. It's Morgan, the prime brokers, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, Citibank, and such. And I think that if you dig down, what people don't understand is if you dig down through Wall Street, you get past the white shoe guys and the Harvard MBAs and such. You start getting into some other people. There's a very blurry line between Wall Street and organized crime. And organized crime, Wall Street is rife with organized crime. The organized crime goes to one particular family in America, and it goes back to Russia. And, in fact, that's what you're going to bring up Gary Weiss. Remember, Gary Weiss made his name reporting on the move of organized crime into Wall Street. It's just that he's been very selective about what he's reported on.
I thought you should explain to our listeners who Gary Weiss is.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, basically, just to, I'll put in some links that explain some of the topics we've covered, like naked short selling. Patrick mentioned that Bloomberg has done some not only articles but videos that explain this a lot. So anyone who's interested in learning more about that can kind of make up their mind for themselves. But now that the story takes on kind of a second turn, which does have a pretty strong technology angle in that it involves Wikipedia and the Wikipedia co-founder, Jimmy Jimbo Wales, Cade's best friend.
Yes.
And so let's start on this second part of the story by looking at the naked short selling article on Wikipedia.
There's really three articles in Overstock, Patrick Byrne, and Naked Short Selling that, you know, you can say if you think that they're fair and balanced articles or not. Kay, do you want to comment?
Well, I would implore our listeners to go and read the Patrick Byrne article on Wikipedia. It's quite a read. I guarantee a laugh or two.
And all the rules which govern, see, not that I'm complaining about this. I don't give a damn what the Wikipedia article on me says. But all the rules that govern the discourse on 2 million pages within Wikipedia have been hijacked, have been suspended when it comes to these pages. It's very odd. And unlike the other Wikipedia stories, which are about some 15-year-old farm kid in Iowa who got a hold of the page on, you know, Caesar Augustus or something and is distorted it, in this case, the actual hierarchy of Wikipedia is, in my view, it's undeniable that they were involved in the hijacking of this. How they have worked is this guy, Gary Weiss, has taken over these articles. And he's taken over these articles, and so he's the frontline soldier. But the hierarchy of Wikipedia, right up to Jimbo Wales and Slim Virgin, have used their uber powers to protect them. So he does the dirty work, and then they just protect them from the
Slim Virgin, for those who don't know, is a Wikipedia administrator of some renown.
Yeah. Right. And also, Gary Weiss has denied just about everything we're about to talk about.
I've spoken to Gary Weiss on the phone. He says that he has never edited Wikipedia.
Okay, well, do you believe him?
Even if we don't comment on whether we believe him or not, I want to give his side since he's not here. And I just want everyone to know that he does.
Yeah, he denies it.
He denies it.
I'll put it this way. I'm about to put up another blog on Gary Weiss. Gary Weiss will just flatly deny everything that he's – but it's totally documentable.
Maybe Cade – I'm going to put a link in it. So Cade did a story in December that covered this ground in detail. It was a huge – on the Register, got hundreds of thousands of reads, and so I'll put a link into that show. Kay, can you give us the quick summary of the major players and
definitely
how Wikipedia works? Maybe
definitely there's a Wikipedia account called Manton Moreland, who along with several other Wikipedia editors clearly exhibits a certain amount of control over four articles. You mentioned three of them: the Patrick Byrne article, the Overstock article, and the Naked Shorting article, but also the Gary Weiss article.
Oh, yeah.
This account, Manton Moreland, created the Gary Weiss article, in addition to heavily editing those other three. It's Patrick Byrne's contention and the contention of his director of communications, Judd Bagley, who's done a lot of...
Judd's not actually that anymore. He does a different job.
Okay, but he is an employee of yours, nonetheless, who has investigated this at length. This dates back 2 years and even more. Regardless, it's your contention that Gary Weiss is behind the Manton Moreland article. And recently on Wikipedia, and this is not in my story, but has recently come out, there's an investigation underway that seems to indicate that the Manson Moreland account is linked to another account. They seem to be run by the same person. So Manton Moreland's biggest defender, or one of his biggest defenders,
Sammy Harris,
would seem to be run by the same person. Regardless, Patrick is right in saying that the Wikipedia hierarchy has vehemently defended these two accounts, whether or not they're driven by the same person or not. They've gone so far as to block large swaths of Utah, where your company is based and where Judd Bagley lives, in an effort to kind of quiet this argument that you're making.
I mean, I would say in an effort to suppress the evidence. You can't, I mean, there's something very odd when you can't mention Judd Bagley within Wikipedia. What Judd did was he created a different site called antisocialmedia.net and started posting this evidence, and very good evidence about how Gary is sock puppeting and hijacking social media in not a random way. I mean, in a pretty scary way. Well, to even mention that becomes grounds for lifetime banishment from Wikipedia.
Okay. That was the case. It is changing now. There is this movement to get to the bottom of this.
But to give you an idea of how insane it got, they created something in the fall called a bad sites policy. Let's have it become a crime, a thought crime within Wikipedia to even mention bad sites. And bad sites, you know, in Wikipedia, you can mention NAMBLA, you can mention kiddie ball, which is a kiddie porn thing. You couldn't mention anti-social media. So they had this long discussion, which Judd said is longer than the New Testament. He compared it on his, this long discussion about the bad sites policy occurred within Wikipedia without them being able to mention the site that was the target of the policy.
That's true, but it should be said that in the end, they decided not to implement this policy. You and Judd and anti-social media, that were the cause of it. In the end, they decided that this wasn't a good thing. But I guess we should also add that another interesting wrinkle here, we've mentioned Jimmy Wales. Whoever's right and whoever's wrong in this argument, Wales has vehemently defended this Manton Moreland account and Sammy Harris account and his administrators, and he has badmouthed you and Judd Bagley and, frankly, the Register as well. The irony is that, and Jimmy Wales has admitted as much on Wikipedia, is that predating our article back in September on an internal Wikipedia mailing list, Jimmy Wales himself said that I want to go on the record as saying that I believe that Manton Moreland,
that it's a fact.
Well, he said he didn't have any proof,
but he said I believe it's a fact.
He said I believe it's a fact.
In addition, I have, and that is one of these things that, I mean, to me, I just say the simple truth, and people say, isn't it crazy to say that? Well,
like I said, I keep saying this. Whoever's right and whoever's wrong, and this is maybe a good analogy for the whole naked shooting thing, okay? Whether or not there's foul play going on here, there is the opportunity for someone to engage in that foul play. Wikipedia is set up as such that if you wanted to rig the system in this way, that you could do it.
And that might seem inconsequential to some people until you realize you throw something like naked short selling into Google, and you know the first thing that just about everybody's going to read is the naked short selling page on Wikipedia. This happens for just about anything, thanks to Google bumping Wikipedia way up in their rankings, and then also the popularity.
Well, I think that is a valid point to make, and people forget that. The Wikipedia is one of the top 10 most read sites on Earth. That is where people get their information, and most people go to Wikipedia and they believe that it's fact.
Right.
And you get the last podcast you had, this fellow Carr, was it?
Nick Carr, right. Carr,
you know, he talked about how social media, how these dynamics in social media that we tend to think of as great can actually really backfire. In this case, what is so scary, and to me, gentlemen, frankly, it's a bit of an indictment of the American journalism profession, because there's all of this complaining about Wikipedia going on, but I think what actually is happening, there's now, among serious people, the whole intellectual battle on within Wall Street, the intellectual battle on naked shorting is over. Chris Cox has come out and said, this is all real, this is true, the regulations we have in place to stop it aren't working. the whole, just a quick aside, a year ago, there was a conference on Wall Street that dealt with this issue. A bunch of economists on one side saying this is all real. A bunch of Wall Street guys on the other saying, no, there's a battle burns, crazy, crazy, crazy. Well, the same conference was held in October this year, and that whole battle's over. Everybody gets, okay, it's just a matter of how do we fix it now.
Chris Cox is the chairman
of the SEC. So even though there's been this enormous financial scandal and fight among powerful people within Wall Street, and I was just on Monday night in a group of 12 hedge funds and the editor of a major magazine on Wall Street with these hedge funds telling the editor, you have to listen, Patrick is right about this, et cetera. So that whole battle has been won. But the Wikipedia article has moved kicking and screaming. And I think what's happened is because if these guys are able to hijack the Wikipedia article, then we go to another reporter at, say, the Financial Times, and we explain what's going on, and we give them the academic papers, and we have them talk to an economist and such who can explain this is true. Well, the first thing they do when we leave the room is they look it up on Wikipedia, and the Wikipedia article says, oh, this is all crazy, and Patrick Byrne is just some guy who's mad. He's out in Utah, and his company sucks, and he should just stick to his company. Well, and it's really an indictment, if I can be frank, of American journalism that, you know, the great dilemma for journalists is you want to be the first to break a story, but you don't want to be 100 yards in front of other people. You want to be 4 yards. And the fact that they can go to Wikipedia and come to believe that there's this consensus around a point of view that is wildly false, demonstrably false, nobody in Wall Street believes anymore, and yet the Wikipedia consensus won't budge because these rules have been hijacked.
That's a good point. But, you're kind of a conspiracy theorist, right?
I didn't say conspiracy.
You know, you see problems with people coming after Overstock from a financial point of view, and then now this stretches to Wikipedia. Don't you kind of see, Judd Begley is just as zealous as some of these Wikipedia editors are. Judd Begley's
Judd is in your employ, right?
He's essentially, it seemed like most of his time was taken up trying to clean up some of this Wikipedia mess. So to the outside observer,
that's not fair what you just said, and I'll tell you why.
It looks like both groups on opposite sides here are just as maybe overzealous as each other.
No. That's totally unfair. Judd was a reporter, and then he became a Web 2.0 reporter, and I didn't know the guy from Adam. He came to interview me for a podcast. We talked for hours, and he ended up going off and saying this is and doing his own research. He thought I was nuts, started finding all the things I would told him he was going to find. And he gradually became a convert. He spent 9 months most of what he put together, actually he put together over a year ago, and on Gary and what was going on within Wikipedia. At that point, about a year, 15 months ago, he became an employer. I never paid him a dime for the first 9 months he did all this stuff. Okay. It was all on his own, and then he joined us.
But you do pay him now. And another point worth making is that you've been quite sure that Jimmy Wales played a bigger role in this than it seems that he does. I mean, clearly.
Why do you say that? I've not been too. Only in the last couple months have I come to really believe Jimmy Wales plays a role. Okay.
But it would seem that, you know, rather than sort of driving things, his role was such that he just let them happen.
The only connection I have of Jimbo is Gary, two things really. Judd was sort of on the verge of exposing Gary some time ago, and the civil war was just starting within Wikipedia. A skirmish was starting on the subject. And Jimbo Wales came in and said, I've looked at the evidence, and I'm putting my name to it. Gary Weiss is not Manton Moreland. Well, that was kind of a strange thing. But other than that, I didn't suspect Jimbo Wales until I learned more recently about his background and looked at more evidence. And I think that he's not as laissez-faire about this.
But so here you are. You're battling Wall Street. You're battling, you know, a website that specializes in trivia, more or less, to some degree. You're supposed to be running, you know, an $800 million company. Is this the best use of your time? Are you just focused on running the business as you should be?
Well, a few responses. First of all, just back to your conspiracy point, I never use the word conspiracy. I'm just laying data out there. If you look at all that stuff and you come and say, oh, this is a conspiracy theory, let me point out, I'm not owning that. You got to own that. You're the one who's looking at this data and saying you see a conspiracy. Now, is this is the best use of my time? I don't see myself as battling Wikipedia. I see myself as battling a massive form of corruption on Wall Street. It's been hard to get journalists to report on it, because there's this linchpin in the discourse that is Wikipedia, and that got hijacked. But and the truth is, and ultimately, no, it's not my job. It isn't my job. But I can reverse that and say, is it really my job to be, and Judd's job to be uncovering all this? Is it our job to have sort of figured out and brought to the public's attention naked short selling? And is it our job to have changed the regulations? Is it our job to have stitched together this unholy alliance between a packet of journalists and the hedge funds? The answer is no, it's not our job. It's your job.
Well, here we are having a podcast. So you've had some board members leave tell me if it's accurate. It's been portrayed as they've left as a result of either the lawsuit on Wall Street or just
your father.
How much attention?
My father, what they don't mention is my father came out of retirement, left our board, and 3 days later became chairman of White Mountain. So he left our board, and he was chairman of our board, and he stopped and became chairman of a major insurance company. And no, he did not leave our board over this issue. The other two people I can't comment on without – I don't want to say anything that's untruthful, but I'd say that how it's reported in the press is not true. It's not quite true. But beyond that, I'm not going to say what the truth is.
Do you get tired of discussing all this thing? You're saying it's not your job, but you still seem to have kind of a lot of passion and enthusiasm when you talk about it, that's for sure.
Well, I'm an enthusiastic guy. It's not that I feel tired. I feel like I'm living – I feel like I want to grab the mic and shout, Soylent Green is people, Soylent Green is people. It's the institutions of our society. Who would have thought that in middle age, here I am becoming a radical Marxist, the institutions of our society have been hijacked by powerful, you know, forces. And we're – you know, companies are being destroyed. The tech industry – to me, it is interesting that although the CEOs and the leaders in the tech industry understand this, it has not permeated the general Bay Area. I get a lot of calls from people out here who want to know about it, but they tend to be more lawyers and that level, especially biotech. People understand what's going on. So it's corny to say. I guess it's just patriotism. Our company. It's like if you were running a brick factory next to a nuclear power plant and you started adding some things up, you saw something fishy and you realize something's going on there, and you put it together and realize there may be a nuclear, you know, at Chernobyl, and you try to bring attention to it, and people say, isn't your job just running the brick factory? Stick to your brick factory. It's like, wait a second. When you get this, if you can't, you know, if you knew that somebody was injecting hepatitis into the nation's blood supply, that isn't something you get to just, like, try to bring awareness to, and it isn't happening, so you go back to whatever you're doing. You have to fight that fight.
What if Warren Buffett came out and said, we're on a house of cards, everyone would listen?
Well, my relationship with Buffett is that part of it is I don't discuss publicly things that he says in private. But his partner, Charlie Munger, has said, came out last May, and somebody asked him just that question, and he said something like, it can't be good for civilization to have all these large, unsettled trades in the clearance system. It's like you don't want that slop in the clearance system. It's for the same reason you don't want slop in a nuclear power plant. Well, that was kind of an odd choice of metaphor. Now, he said that publicly, so I feel I can quote him on it.
So not to be crass or to make light of the situation, but if your life was threatened, if you ever mentioned naked short selling again, and not only have you mentioned it, but you've put a loudspeaker behind it even more, why hasn't something happened then?
You'll have to wait for the movie to come out to find out what happened next. But something happened next. I'm holding out for Denzel Washington to play me.
So you're saying,
wasn't somebody came from overseas, there's witnesses, there may even be, anyway, I'm not going to go beyond what happened next, but it was quite an adventuresome part of my life.
So what, they've backed down from doing the ultimate kind of threat? You think it was just, they were threatening you, they did some things, but...
I'm bulletproof and invisible. And no other, it's some that when the movie comes out, you can find out what happened next.
Okay.
I'm going to stop there.
Anyone who wants to get into more detail on all this stuff, there's plenty of places to
go.
Go
to Deep Capture. DeepCapture.com is my blog, if you want to know.
Yeah, no, I'll definitely put a link in as well. And yeah, Patrick goes into, you know, extensive detail on a lot of these issues, and we've got Cade stories, and there's other stuff out on the internet. I think we've given everyone a lot to chew on for the moment, unless Cade had anything else that he wanted to...
Well, the other question my wife wanted to ask, has anyone from Bravo TV approached you about Millionaire Matchmaker?
No.
I guess
should
not.
I be...
Okay. I've done my duty now. We can move on.
Okay.
I haven't even seen that.
Neither have I.
Well, Patrick, you know, thank you so much for coming out to the office and making time for us today. Really appreciate it.
Pleasure's been a real pleasure.